Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today, in Soundcheck History.
Hey, Soundcheckers, it's John Schaefer once again in the Soundcheck Workshop. With the radio show on hiatus this summer, we're trying out some new things on the website and here on the podcast. Today is June 5th, a day of some big moments, high and low, in music history. In 1956, Elvis Presley brought his new single Hound Dog to the Milton Berle Show and scandalized the audience with a swing and a swivel of his hips. A high or a low? In 1964, on this date, the Rolling Stones started their first tour of the States at the Swing Auditorium in San Bernardino, California. Then-bassist Bill Wyman called the tour a disaster. And that was bad, although things would look up the following year when I Can't Get No Satisfaction made the band international stars. And on a celebratory note, today is the birthday of avant-garde composer, musician, and performer Laurie Anderson. Happy birthday, Laurie. What about this date in soundcheck history? Well, back on June 5th, 2009, we marked the 25th anniversary of what some consider to be the greatest pop film soundtrack of all time, Purple Rain by Prince. Recently, that very soundtrack was added to the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress, an archive of musical works considered to be culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. You can visit the Soundcheck page to hear our full interview with the library's curator and to find out about the other works added to the archive this year, which included a 124-year-old singing doll. But back to our archives, in 2009, we spoke with Evan Soddy of the culture site Pop Matters, and I began by asking Evan about his personal relationship with the great Purple One.
Well, I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and though I had a wonderful parents and things like that, I wasn't exactly prone to pop music. I didn't even know my Nirvana from my Michael Jackson until I was about 14, 15, and once I finally got into pop music, I dived into it wholeheartedly. The funny thing is that it wasn't until a year and a half ago when, just kind of on a whim, I heard of Prince for really the first time, and all of a sudden, when I picked up this album, it was an eye-opening experience. This, for me, was one of the most perfect pop constructs ever made, and as such, I then began looking at everything else about it, the movie, the fashion, everything else it inspired, and when I realized it was turning 25, I asked if anyone else had anything to say, and surprisingly, everyone did.
Well, it was one of the big hits of the 1980s. You mentioned the movie, the fashion. I mean, how important was that in the success of the record?
Well, one of the things is that it's because of the fact that Prince finally had a platform for himself beyond just the regular music format. With his previous album, 1999, he had finally, for the first time, really found his pop stride. He finally had songs like 1999, things like that, but he was still a mid-level star. People kind of knew about him. He then began talking to his manager about doing this movie project as well, and all of a sudden he was able to convince Warner Brothers, against all odds, to release a movie about him, starring him, and featuring nothing but brand new songs as well. It just so happens that during the 1999 tour, he got together a band of people that were able to fully flesh out his sound. Normally, he plays everything himself. And now, all of a sudden, here are some people that were able to show him new directions to go in. And so, really, I had mentioned in my opening essay that he picked the perfect time to perfect his art. And truly, he did. The one time when everyone in the world was watching, he wound up releasing the strongest material he had ever crafted. So, really, it was a multi-tiered, multimedia effort on his part.
It sounds like a real triumph of a number of things, but it also sounds kind of calculated. Was it?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole purpose of Purple Rain was it was supposed designed to make him a superstar. I mean, he's still the kid to a degree, but everyone else in the movie, Apollonia, Morris Day, all people from his real life. He even has, of course, the song near the end of the album slash movie, Baby, I'm a Star, which is a declaration of his own success, of his own wanting for fame at the same time. So very much in that way, it was designed to make him a star. But I don't think even Prince and Warner Brothers were able to anticipate just just how much of a star it was able to make him, because the movie went on to do $76 million. It won Oscars. He won Grammys. He became an overnight sensation, and the album was number one for over half a year, practically. So because of that, he himself was a little taken back, and that's why the album he released following that was an excursion into psychedelic rock, completely different.
But we're talking about the album Purple Rain, which came out 25 summers ago and spawned several hit singles, including this number one, When Doves Cry. Doves Cry, one of several hit singles from the album Purple Rain, released 25 years ago this summer, and the subject of a series of essays in Pop Matters. Pop Matters associate editor Evan Saudi is my guest, and we're talking about this album, which was the number one record, had topped the singles charts, and also number one on MTV and in the movie theaters. Evan, in your series of essays there at Pop Matters, one essayist calls Darlin' Nikki, that song, the anti-Billie Jean, which, what do you think that means?
Well, a lot of it is the fact we have to remember the context of which Purple Rain emerged. In 1983, Thriller was everywhere. Michael Jackson was the king of pop, truly, and no one was going to question that. Yet his image was very clean-cut, very sanitized, and decidedly non-sexual at the same time. For Prince, Darlin' Nikki, he did the exact antithesis of that. Some would argue almost calculatedly, as James Fleming argues in his essay as well. Because here's a song about a very promiscuous woman that he happens to meet, that's married to an incredibly hard rock line at the same time. It really is, in many ways, the exact opposite of that song. It's completely different just in terms of sheer context.
But there is, I mean, if we're going to talk about the context, we have to talk about what Darlin' Nikki spawned, which was those PRMS, you know, hearings in the Senate and all the stickers and talk of censorship and the industry voluntarily capitulating after those Senate hearings to put the stickers on discs. Was this a good thing for music?
You know, it's kind of interesting that several years down the line, even this particular Parents Music Resources Council Center that Tipper Gore formed wound up actually going over Prince. He, in his later 90s albums, on the Love Symbol album, it had the parental advisory sticker right across it. It's hard to determine. In the same way, there was a lot of resistance when the TV ratings changes came out for the first time, or even some of the MPAA's more famous decision. For a lot of people at the same time, it allows parents to kind of get a sense of what is acceptable for their children. Some people want to make sure that everyone hears, you know, in the right context, certain things. They don't want to be surprised by an F-bomb dropping here when it's someone who's 7 years old, for that matter, as well. So ultimately, the debate still rages on. But in terms of Prince, the most fascinating thing about the whole Darlin' Nikki scandal is all of a sudden everyone's listening. They hear this song, but as you well know, it was not his dirtiest song by any means.
Not by a long stretch.
No. Look at Dirty Mind when he really began pressing the sexual politics of everything.
But when the Parental Music Resource Center created its list of the 15 most offensive songs back in 1984, this one topped it. Name on a dotted line, the lights went out, and Nikki started to grind. Castle started spinning, oh, maybe it was. Little bit of Darlin' Nikki from Prince, controversial song from the album Purple Rain, and the one that Tipper Gore found her young daughter listening to, and that's what spurred all those Senate hearings and the Parental Music Resource Center and ultimately the parental advisory stickers that we still find on many records today. Evan Saudi is the associate editor at PopMatters.com, which is doing a whole series of essays looking back at Purple Rain for its 25th anniversary and the lingering echoes in music and in censorship issues and things like that. Evan, two of the essays explore how Prince's his acclaim, his popularity, went into places you wouldn't have expected. The new wave crowd, the heavy metal fans. How was he able to do that?
Well, a part of the reason is the fact that he never once fit into one particular genre. If you listen to his very, very first album, For You, it's a straight-up R&B album. But following that, he began doing overtures to other genres as well. On his second album, just his second album, it still has light disco R&B classics, but there's a song on there called Bambi, which is a hard-rocking, Hendrix-esque style, you know, number, which is very not typical for R&B fare in the late 70s, early 80s. What he managed to do was meld all these different styles together into something wholly distinctive for himself as well. And as such, he was able to court a larger audience. There were people that came in for the R&B songs and wound up getting turned on to the hard rock numbers, and rockers that thought he was the next incarnation of Hendrix with his wild soloing and was still able to seduce them with an R&B ballad. He took black music and white music and made it something whole that was able to appeal to masses of people, regardless of background.
He took black music and white music and he made something purple out of it. It's essentially what he did.
Absolutely.
The album is Purple Rain, and it celebrates its 25th anniversary this summer. We've been speaking with Evan Saudi, the associate editor at PopMatters.com. And Evan, fascinating series of essays. Thanks for sharing some of them with us on Soundcheck today.
Thanks for having me on.
Here's a little bit of one of the more unlikely tracks from Purple Rain. Computer Blue is the name of it. From Soundcheck History, the popular and popularly controversial Purple Rain on the occasion of its 25th anniversary. That was back in 2009. Now another moment from today in Soundcheck, June 5th, 2008. Guitarist Gian Reilly is the son of the influential composer Terry Reilly, and he stopped by the studio to play live. Here's a live improvisation followed by a few short etudes on guitar from the Soundcheck studio. Thank you. Was composer and guitarist Gian Reilly live in our studio back on this date, June 5th in 2008. You can hear the rest of that in-studio performance and my interview with Gian Reilly in the audio archives for that date, and you've been listening to
Today in Soundcheck History.
There's more where this came from. The Soundcheck archive is full of videos, podcasts, and more. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook for updates on our summer redesign, and visit us at our summer website, soundcheckworkshop.org. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. The show is produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn. Our intern is Alex Abnos. Thanks to Andy Lancet and the WNYC Archives. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer for the Soundcheck Podcast.